Good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with you. And an honor to just share some understanding that that comes from both like the years of my practice as a yogi, but also sitting with you. And it's deeply inspiring to be with each of you and to feel the power of your practice and the strength of it, even if you think that's not the case, it is. And to experience your courage and your generosity in so many ways, it's just an incredible gift to be in community with all of you and with my two colleagues. So tonight I'd like to speak about practices that we can take with us, bring home, continue to cultivate in our daily lives, practices that the Buddha talked about. And before that, though, I became very curious over the course of listening to others and relating to others in terms of what comes up in relationship to loving kindness practice and practicing in this intensive way. And what it brought me to was the question, what is the impediment, or what is one of the impediments to practicing loving kindness or feeling the ease of practicing loving kindness? Maybe that's even a clearer question. So I have some questions for you to get that going. And one is, how many of us have felt unworthy in receiving loving kindness from a benefactor? Some of us, yeah. How many have found it easier to offer loving kindness than perhaps to receive it? Yeah, some more. Yeah. How many have found it easier to offer to a neutral person than someone you know? Anyone? A few. Yeah. No, it can be easy access, neutral person. How many have found it completely easy to offer loving kindness to your difficult person? Really? All right. Get a few. Yeah. That's great. You know, that really probably is a sign that you're in this container where there's a lot of momentum built up and concentration, so that even in the face of difficulty, you know, we can find that pathway to care for someone who's difficult for us. It's a powerful practice, and it's why it really isn't offered in the beginning of loving kindness practice in a retreat, because it tends to be more difficult. So what I began to contemplate was this impediment that comes up when the mind says things like, I'm not really getting it, or it could be better, or why aren't I feeling loving kindness all the time? How come this practice isn't working? Or it could be that it comes in relationship to others. I really got it down here. But that person over there is kind of restless, and look at them. They didn't come into the hall like for three sittings, and, you know. But I'm really down with the loving kindness practice, you know. It can be humorous to watch our minds, our comparing minds. One of the sources I have discovered that feels like an impediment is perfectionism. A teacher of mine, Marion Woodman, was a, some of you may be familiar with her. She's not, she's on another plane right now, not an airplane. But she wrote a book called Addiction to Perfection. I love the title. And I love the title because I know, we are in a culture that reinforces that over and over again in so many ways. And so even if we don't subscribe to perfectionism, it's kind of in the Kool-Aid, isn't it? You know, culturally. I mean, perfectionism is really in that mentality, that systemic, supremacist way of thinking, even that any one person is better than another. It's fostered on othering. It's fostered on there's a certain way to be. There's a certain right skin color to have, or gender, or sexual identity, or way our body is, or way our mind is, or way our emotions are. There's a right way. There's a correct way. And if we're not in that correct way, some way we're failing. We're scrambling. We're suffering. And you might say, well, you know, I don't subscribe to that. I don't believe in that. I'm very committed to social justice or peace. I don't see others as other. And I believe you because I feel the same way. And yet when we practice and look at our own hearts, so often we can see the othering just in relationship to our own heart, to our own direct experience. You know, that it's not quite right. It could be better. You know, if I just sat completely still, or, you know, if this morning, you know, if I just did every sitting, you know, I shouldn't have taken that nap, or, you know, or maybe it's like, yeah, I don't really care. You know, I don't really need to listen to the instructions. I I've got it figured out. And then before you know it, you feel kind of too far out, too disconnected. You know, it can be so predicated on this sense of disconnection and othering. It is in the Kool-Aid. So what do we do? What do we do about that? I mean, in some ways, to me, it just points naturally to how important Dharma practice is. And maybe, you know, maybe for you there's another spiritual practice that you do, or another religion that you're involved in that really cultivates these qualities of loving kindness and forgiveness and equanimity. And, you know, as the Dalai Lama said, you know, my only religion is kindness. He also said, you know, Buddhist centers are welcome to everyone. So this isn't really about, like, you know, Buddhism is the only way. I don't believe that. But because it's my practice, I can really speak to the teachings that have transformed my heart and mind. And I imagine just even the few days that you've been here, you've experienced some of that yourselves. This is a quote from David White. Some of you might be familiar with David White, Irish poet. I think he speaks to what perfectionism hides and covers over. And if we keep going through those questions of what's really happening here underneath the it could be better, I want to get this, if we keep going underneath that, we might be in touch with the deep not knowing of this very moment, the deep vulnerability of just being with whatever is present, whatever that is. He says, vulnerability is not a weakness, a passing indisposition or something we can arrange to do without. Vulnerability is not a choice. Vulnerability is the underlying, ever-present, and abiding undercurrent of our natural state. To run from vulnerability is to run from the essence of our nature. The attempt to be invulnerable is the vain attempt to become something we are not. And yet, you know, when we really look at what's the, you know, what feeds the horrors really in our world, it's that denial of vulnerability. It's that denial of our interconnectedness. It's the ultimate delusion to think that we're separate. The ultimate delusion. And what comes from that delusion is greed and hatred. The Buddha talked about these as poisons. When we see them in our world, we might see them in small ways, and then we see them in absolutely devastating ways. Sometimes I think, you know, we don't really have time to waste, and maybe that's because of I'm a certain age. Maybe that's because of what we're facing right now with wars and proliferation of ill will and ignorance, climate change. And then I think, you know, what the Buddha talked about 2,600 years ago, what he said is the world is on fire. The world is on fire. So we have this incredible privilege and opportunity and circumstance, causes and conditions to be here together in this room for these days. Any of you thought, like, how did this happen? How do I get to do this? And there's really no answer to that, causes and conditions. I mean, it can flip into a sense of unworthiness, you know, and that's something to bring our hearts to. Pay attention. Remember that Buddha touched the earth, you know, by nature of being a human being. By nature of being a human being, I am worthy. I am worthy of complete and full liberation of heart and mind amidst all of life's circumstances. And we are worthy. David White, the only choice we have as we mature is how we inhabit our vulnerability, how we become larger and more courageous and more compassionate through our intimacy with disappearance, the coming and going of things. Our choice is to inhabit vulnerability as generous citizens of loss, robustly and fully, or conversely, as misers and complainers, reluctant and fearful, always at the gates of existence, but never bravely and completely attempting to enter, never wanting to risk ourselves, never walking fully through the door. Every time you sit down on a cushion and have that resolve to sit in a meditation practice, to do your walking practice, that's walking through the door. This is not an easy practice. This is from bell hooks. Anyone familiar with bell hooks? Beautiful Dharma, inspiring human being, passed away a few years ago. When we choose to love, we choose to move against fear, against alienation and separation. The choice to love is a choice to connect, to find ourselves in the other. She also said, we cannot know love if we remain unable to surrender our attachment to power. If any feeling of vulnerability strikes terror in our hearts, lovelessness torments. There's a power in vulnerability. It's like that's cutting through the great delusion of these times. Audre Lorde, Black feminist poet, lesbian poet. I had the privilege to be in her presence many years ago when I was a student. She said, when I dare to be powerful, to use my strength in the service of my vision, then it becomes less and less important whether I am afraid. We don't have to run from fear. It's just fear. We can actually meet it with curiosity, with compassion, with love. It's part of our human condition. And so often fear and courage go together. Do you ever notice that? No? You find yourself speaking up when you didn't intend to, or holding your ground in a way that is needed and takes courage. It's not like fear has disappeared. It's there. It's interesting. Compassion itself is described as the quivering of the heart. Quivering of the heart. It feels. That takes strength. It takes strength to meet our vulnerability. I don't know about the rest of you, but I certainly grew up with, oh, Jean, you're too sensitive. Anyone know that one? Right? Or, you know, if you're a girl, you're supposed to do this. If you're a boy, you're supposed to do that. Oof. There's so much conditioning. And the Buddha talked about this, really, in the first two Noble Truths. He talked about suffering exists. No, you can't get away from it. Second one, there are causes of it. There are causes when we try to push away what's difficult. We try to hold on to what feels good. Anybody find yourself having moments of openings during the retreat, feeling open-hearted and connected? It's like, I got it. I'm on the ride now. You know, and then maybe a few sittings later, it's like, oh, oof, just assaulted with sleepiness or irritation or a memory or perseverating about something that really bugged you. You know, I spent a whole week-long loving-kindness retreat being pissed off. Really, the whole week. And it just, you know, it just dawned on me at the end of the week. It was like, because of course, all along with the being pissed off was, you shouldn't be, right? They go together. What's wrong with you? You know, and the story kept coming, the feeling kept coming, and I kept trying to, may I be happy? You know, may that person be happy? And, you know, whoa. And, you know, near the end of the week, it was like, you know, you're just angry. It's just anger. It's just anger there. It was like, poof. You know. Whole thing disappeared. And it was all related to not accepting what was happening. So we get ideas even about what loving kindness is. Somebody today in one of the groups said, I don't know how to love. I thought that was incredibly profound. and honest and really interesting. So if we have this courage, you know, what does it take to sustain it? You know, what does it take? Because here we are in this environment where we have enormous support here, don't we? I mean, even if it's like something irritates you, don't you notice later it's like, oh my God, there's food, you know, there's staff, there's like, if I can write a note and the staff will respond and take care of it, I mean, who lives with that? You know, where does that exist? I mean, it's and I'm not suggesting that you haven't had disappointments maybe with circumstances here. It's not a perfect environment, but it certainly does a pretty good job supporting yogis on retreat, I have to say. At least that's been my experience on both realms, both as a yogi and as a teacher. And people care. When I have permission from the staff to say this, one of the staff in the front office was just came in like glowing this morning, and she's like, I just, you know, someone came in to tell me this story about their heart opening, and she's like, I just feel so open. My heart is so open, and it feels like the Grinch, you know, when the Grinch heart gets bigger and bigger. It was so sweet to like feel her happiness and joy, and her being touched with what one of you shared with her. That's Kool-Aid too. I mean, it's true in the sense that, you know, what the Buddha talked about in that second noble truth, he said, it doesn't have to stay like that. That's where we get into the third. You know, there's a way out or a way through this entanglement of wanting and not wanting and never getting really satisfied from that, which doesn't mean we don't enjoy, you know, chocolate ice cream or little gifts from Bonnie or... She gives a lot of them. It's really sweet. You know, it's that can be kind of the shadow side of Buddhist practice, that I'm not supposed to enjoy life. That is not what the Buddha said. There's so many joys. It's like William Blake said, you know, kiss the joy as it flies. Support for our practice is really important. And I'm sure we'll talk about that tomorrow too. But it bears speaking to now. That, you know, if you have ways to connect with a local sangha, that's awesome. But there's so much online. There's so many teachings online, writings and offerings, even retreats now, you know, since the pandemic. It's interesting, as I was exploring this, you know, really kind of jamming on perfectionism, like, wow, like that really, it's a cause and it's a condition and it's the, you know, full delusion, and it functions in a way to distort our lives. And then I realized the thing that I wanted to talk to you about is the 10 perfections. So there we have another way of understanding perfection. And the 10 perfections the Buddha offered, they're also called 10 virtues or paramis. We've been practicing them this week, and we can practice them and work with them and relate to them in our lives. So I'd like to go over some of them with you and see how you might resonate with them. So I'll just list them all, and then we can go over them a bit. There's generosity, morality or sila or non-harm, renunciation, wisdom, energy or effort, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and equanimity. And these are energies, really, that we can cultivate, as we have been during this week. We've been cultivating loving kindness. I'm assuming there's no way you couldn't be cultivating patience sitting on a meditation retreat. You know, it takes energy, effort, determination. But those are things we don't just need on a retreat. Those are qualities that we can cultivate in our lives that really support the awakening of the mind and heart. Anthony de Mello, who is a Jesuit sage, Catholic, but he wasn't so accepted by the Catholics, unfortunately. But what he did say was, freedom is the unequivocal, wholehearted, complete acceptance of the inevitable. That's freedom. Now, does that mean that we are just like, okay? No. No. Sometimes that no is a really strong one. No. You can't. You can't cross that line with me. Sometimes we need to head for the hills to take care of our wounded hearts. Sometimes we need that fetal position, that curling up, so that we can just tend to the wounded heart. And no matter how many times we say 10,000 prostrations of may I be happy, in those moments, all we need really is the tender message of it's okay. It's okay. Take your time. Your heart will heal. Your heart will find its way if you give it the time and you give it the respect that it's asking for. Because we're not always going to get that from the outside. When I dare to be powerful, it becomes less and less important whether or not I'm afraid. That was said by a woman who is black and a lesbian. So there's no way that she had like, hey, don't we accept you in this world? When I dare to be powerful, it matters less whether or not I'm afraid. It it's amazing, really, how the practice flowers. I was so enjoying, as I'm sure so many of you were, listening to Bruni's stories last night. Like, just they were just these stories of just the flowering of the Dhamma, you know, in the grocery store with the chicken, you know? And there it is, like that beautiful connection. I was in the woods. I was going to say the day of the pandemic. The day of the eclipse. Wouldn't it be, yeah, if the pandemic was one day, that would be something. It was the day of the eclipse. And I have this dog. How many people have dogs here? Yeah, all right. So, you know, or how many people have friends with dogs? Or, yeah, so, you know, you kind of know, maybe, the dog scene. So, you know, they are instinctual creatures. And I have a very instinctual creature who's about 4 years old. And I would say she's pretty well trained. We certainly paid for that with this dog. However, her instinctual nature is to hunt and run. And this just like, this creature needs that. And she needs like big running. So it's good. It gets me out, gets me to walk in the woods. And I have a little guidance that helps her come back again. She gets a little vibration to come back again. So we're in the woods, and I know she likes to hunt, and it's there aren't any other people. It's a pathway. So Maddie's off hunting, and I'm walking, and I'm start to call her, and she's not coming. And this is not that unusual. She comes back when she wants, when she's done. But, you know, it's usually very safe. We're in the woods. And so, you know, getting a little more irritated, calling her a little louder, and she's not coming. But the next thing I know, this man is, like, walking down the side of the mountain. And it had just snowed in Massachusetts. So he's got these galoshes on, and he's got kind of like a t-shirt on. It was an interesting mix of what he was wearing. And anyway, he's walking down, and he's not looking like super friendly, I have to say. And I'm the only one on the path, and so I'm just thinking, I was thinking a little bit, wow, is he hiking? You know, anyway, he came near me, and I was holding onto the leash, but there was no dog, of course. And he said, "You gotta use that leash." And he was gruff and blustery, and you know, my first reaction was, I won't swear, but my first reaction was like, you know, this is a place where my dog gets to run, you know? I didn't say that to him, but it was something like, well, I know, and I named the guy who owns the land, and he's like, now that didn't go anywhere, that I knew the owner of the land, you know? So he was continuing to, like, make his point, and, you know, I've been to the dog officer, and I've been to my neighbors, and you know, he's trying to find the owner of this dog. So clearly, it wasn't just this one time. You know, and dog's like eating my cat food. You know, my 15-year-old cat's afraid of the dog. You know, I'm kind of like, I'm ready to like, you know, I've got a right to walk here with my dog, and I started that way a little bit, but the more I listened to him, I was like, he's got a point. You know, so I did definitely, you know, it was a switch. It was just a switch. It was going from like I need to defend myself and you know, sort of counter the shame I'm feeling right now that I don't have control over my dog. And because then I even said, well, what kind of dog was it? And he said, Brindle. I was like, oh, okay. But, you know, then he slipped something and he's like, yeah, and you know, she crosses the road and that road's like a highway. So all of a sudden I'm hearing about Maddie's world when I think she's running in the woods. Now she's going elsewhere. So I just said, what's your name? And he said, Keith. I said, Keith. And I said, well, I'm Jean. You know, and I said, I'm really sorry. I really get it. And Maddie still wasn't coming back. I was like, oh, God. I wanted to say, you know, she really likes cats, but, you know, it's like she's eating the cat food, you know. Okay. There was something about that experience that was so sweet. Oh, I can just see him right now. And, you know, there was that one moment when I just wanted to defend. Just wanted to make my point. Just wanted to claim my space. And I didn't need to. And that's the Dharma. That's the Dharma practice. That's the flowering of that. No, it's not a huge story, is it? But it was just so uplifting, you know. And he, you know, I could feel him soften. The problem is, though, I did walk with her the next day, and I did really have her right in my eye, and then suddenly she was gone again. So that I kind of went through the whole thing of, oh no, she gonna land in his yard? I mean, she didn't, but. And it was also interesting that I was mad at her. I had to really watch that I was mad at my dog for being a dog. You know, like for a few days. I just noticed like I couldn't be like, oh, hi, honey. I was like, not really happy with you, Maddie. You know? And it was just, you know, it's the way of being human. She didn't know, you know, she's just being herself. But, you know, we're not that separate. You know, even though he has a sign on his lawn that's like anti, you know, gun control. And I live in a little town, so it has some like long-term New England townies, generations, that may have certain politics that aren't like mine. My street is like that. Everyone gets along. We all really care about each other. You know, I guess it renewed my faith in humanity that we can have a conversation like that even though there's an upset, there's a sense of, in some ways in both sides, there was a sense of trespass. Unintended, of course. Unintended. And maybe these aren't so big when it comes to the huge things in the world that we don't have control over, the things that tear us up. I mean, there's people in this room that have family members that live in war-torn countries. You know, there's every single one of us has a story to tell about our losses, our heartbreaks, the ways we've been transgressed in much more extreme ways than I just described. How do we meet that? Can we meet it with compassion? Sometimes even with forgiveness. Not always, but sometimes we can with forgiveness. And can we meet it with wisdom? And I guess that's the way I'd like to end with our last few minutes of the talk is wisdom. And, you know, Bruni and Bonnie were bringing this in throughout, that how much wisdom is part of loving kindness and loving kindness part of wisdom. They're really inseparable. But without it, without wisdom, without the understanding that things are as they are, we can't really practice loving kindness. We're going to topple over. We're going to get oversaturated, or we're going to struggle. We're going to over-try, over-exert, trying to be loving when the heart is saying, not now. Nope, this heart is closed right now. No. Or when we think it's all about me. And it's not like, you know, there's a suggestion to get dissociated and not recognize one's own direct experience. But it doesn't take much if you're sitting here in the hall and your heart is breaking or your heart is in full joy to remind yourself others are feeling that too. This is the world. This is the world of, as the Buddha said, samsara. This is the world of being human. This is the world of 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. This is the world of so many things we can't control. This is the world of incredible beauty. This is the world of love and hate. This is the world of pleasure and pain. This is the world of sorrow and joy. This is the world of loss and gain. Of one day you're famous and the next day you're forgotten or reputed. It's not fair, but it is what it is. And so how do we meet that without indifference or giving up? The Buddha said, you know, it's possible to be with things as they are, with a heart that understands that, with a heart and mind that understands. When we can recognize this is the world, then compassion naturally arises. It doesn't have to be cultivated. It's born of wisdom. It's born of seeing, here's our human condition, ourselves included. And so we can cultivate that equanimity just like we cultivated, if you will, loving kindness here. The equanimity phrase is, it's interesting just to share with you that in the teachings, who is suggested is the easiest one to offer equanimity practices for, and I'll tell you in a minute what the phrases are for that, is the neutral person. It's the neutral person. So those equanimity phrases, one, it could be simply, things are as they are. Or while I may wish happiness for you, things are as they are. Or a longer version, all beings are the owners of their own actions. Their happiness or unhappiness depends upon their actions and not upon my wishes for them. You'd say that for yourself. I'm the owner of my own actions. My happiness or unhappiness depends upon my actions and not upon my wishes for myself. Now, sometimes people find that cold or hard, but actually there can be an incredible tenderness in it. You know, from this simple place of, no, I really need to get more exercise as I open the refrigerator door, you know, or, you know, it's like recognizing your intention. That's powerful, to recognize one's intention. And at some point, an action happens. I mean, how many of us in this room have worked with addiction in ourselves or with a family member? And at some point, the conditions sometimes come together where there's a releasing. And sometimes that's not the case. Sometimes that's not the case. And we lose people we love. Heartbreakingly so. And these are the conditions of being alive. That person did the best they could with what they had. There's a tremendous invitation to understand our human condition with a boundless, immeasurable, open, full heart. I wish that for all of us and for all beings, even though we know it's not how it is, we can still offer our blessing and wish for well-being. So thank you for listening, for taking in what is nourishing for you, and just for being here. So let's sit together just for a couple of minutes. Just feeling the beating of your own heart and recognizing your goodness. This was an instruction from the Buddha. First thing, actually, with loving kindness practice is to recognize your goodness. And this is from Jane Hirschfeld. I'd just like to read this for you. She's a poet, Buddhist practitioner too. I have been given this existence, these years on this earth, to accept what has come into my lifetime. Wars, loves, trucks, betrayals, kindness. I must take them. I must find a way to live in this world. You can't refuse it. And along with the difficult is the radiant, the beautiful, the intimacy with which each one of us enters the life of all of us and figures out, what is our conversation? What is my responsibility? What must be suffered? What can be changed? How can I meet this in a way which both lets me open my eyes the next day? And also, perhaps, if I'm lucky, can be of service. May this be so. May all beings receive the benefits of our practice here. Today, now, in the future, for all time. Thank you. So it's time to enjoy some walking in the night air if you want to step outside or together in the building, and we'll come back together to chant the Divine Abidings.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.